I want to start with a little exercise today. And what this is going to be is, Anya, I've asked Anya to help me read a dialogue, a very brief dialogue. And she and I are going to be standing at either end of the room here. I'll be standing down here. She'll be standing down there, and we'll try to read as loudly as possible. If you can imagine that, go ahead and stand up there. There is a line between us, between Andrea and I. It's a continuum. And we will be representing two opposite but very legitimate viewpoints found within the church, found within our society about a particular part of what we're talking about today, militarism or the arms race. And so we'll represent two ends of the spectrum. There's a line between us. After we're done reading this dialogue, I would like for you all to stand up and come and place yourselves somewhere along this continuum, wherever you feel most comfortable. All right? And we'll talk about that, where people are standing and why you feel pulled to one side rather than another, and we'll have a little discussion about that. Does everyone understand? Okay. After we're done, stand wherever you feel most comfortable. We'll try to read as loudly as possible. Andrea will start.
It's a sin to build a nuclear weapon.
No, it's not as simple as that. It may put us in an ethical dilemma to build nuclear weapons, and certainly it could never be justified to use them on a civilian population, but one can't say that just to build them is immoral.
But of course it must be immoral to prepare to do something that's immoral. The fact that we keep building them makes it more likely that we will use them. You know, we've used just about every weapon we've built.
That's not quite true. By keeping up with the Russians and building weapons, we've created a balance of power in which actual nuclear warfare has been prevented for more than four decades. So in reality, the building of nuclear weapons could be seen as part of our peacekeeping responsibility. And that's the dilemma we're in. To use the weapons could not be justified, but if the presence of them prevents war in some way, then maybe they do serve a useful purpose.
But we're called to be peacemakers, not just peacekeepers. And even though nuclear weapons haven't been used in over 40 years, the building of more weapons of destruction doesn't make peace, nor do they necessarily even keep the peace. They move us closer to war, which could destroy life as we know it. Not only is it immoral to use them, it's immoral to have them, because they can only lead to unthinkable destruction.
I know we should not think of the weapons as a good. They're not. But they are a reality, and they are a necessity if we're to survive in this age. It may be morally ambiguous to build nuclear weapons, but in a sinful world, it's the only choice we have. Okay, that's the dialogue, and please stand up and try to place yourself somewhere where you feel most comfortable or... Now don't be influenced or intimidated by where other people stand. There's room for plenty of disagreement within a group. Now you can bunch up, if you want to bunch up, you can bunch up, but sometimes when I do this, I have everybody standing in the middle. This group needs to be pretty spread out. I just want to spend a few minutes seeing if there's any conversation here. Obviously, these two viewpoints don't necessarily represent Andrea's or my viewpoints necessarily, but two legitimate viewpoints, and all of you are somewhere in between. Does anyone want to just say why they're standing, where they're standing, or why they're not standing somewhere else?
Yeah, I think the...
loudly, so people down there can hear
you. I think the dimension that we're not talking about in these two conversations, we can talk about our Christian beliefs, which I would say would probably put me at the other end. But a majority of our world is not Christian, and they don't have the same philosophy. Therefore, I think we have to maintain our status as we have.
Anybody else from right here? Okay.
I was sitting on a destroyer up in the North Pacific off the coast of Japan at the time that the first bomb was dropped. Had that bomb not been dropped in a few weeks, we would have made landings in Japan. I'm not sure I would be here now to talk about it, because that would have been a rough, rough time. My other thought on it is that having dropped the bomb, regretfully, we know the consequence of the bomb. And I think we are much more cautious about the possible use of the bomb. Even though we are making them, we know what the consequences can be because the bombs have been dropped.
Okay, thank you. Good. Anybody else?
Well, I think I'm here because of the money that the bombs cost and all the rigmarole for war, which we need so much for the poor and helping people.
Okay.
I apologize for standing here. I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking for the children that I taught in school at Hanford many, many years ago, whose parents were taken away from their livelihood as orchardists and grape growers and farmers, and were put into the manufacture of they didn't know what, but they were paid a good salary. They gave up other livelihood to be there, and now they feel that they have a right to continue that kind of employment, whether it's making bombs or making fertilizer or cleaning up the mess. They feel that they have a right to employment.
Okay. A couple more before we quit. Down there, okay? Yep, go ahead.
I'm living in the backyard of the Trident nuclear submarines, and they are not defensive weapons, they're first strike weapons. That's what we have come to.
Okay, so that's what pulls you down that way. There was another hand up here.
Yeah, I'm saying that I think that nuclear bombs are obsolete. And there's just absolutely no sanity in even considering them as a way of settling a problem of any kind. And I'd rather use a wet noodle than that.
Unfortunately, we've probably already crossed the line of control, because if peaceful nations do not have them, then we may be destroyed by somebody else that we can't control.
Right. Okay, so that's what pulls you down, that other nations have them, so we better, okay?
Exactly. I think we've had 40 years of relative peace, which is a longer period of time than we've had for a long time. And I think what pulls me down here is probably the first 10 years of that 40 years, when things were really kind of shaky in terms of the political situation between our country and the Soviet Union.
And if we become weak, we could drift back into that situation again.
Okay. Let's have one more and then we'll stop. Right, we'll have someone sort of toward the middle to finish it off.
Okay. I don't believe we should become weak, but I think that we shouldn't spend so much money on destructive weapons. I don't know. I think some of those companies that have been building all those weapons, why can't they diversify like other companies have and figure out more peaceful occupations to put these people to work in?
Okay. There were a couple more hands. We'll just take them, the hands that were already up, and then we'll back there. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm standing where I am because I believe it is a valid objection that we cannot
As loud as you can.
That we cannot divest ourselves entirely of nuclear weapons. But at the same time, we don't need as much as we have. And we could reduce the expenditures on that a great deal. And instead of relying entirely upon armaments, we should start fostering some kind of a peace academy or peace institute, which would replace confrontation with negotiation.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a very helpful way to start. We're going to talk today about the costs of war making, or having not only a military, but what I think is has crossed the line from military preparedness to what is called militarism. I'm going to try to make that clear in as many ways as I can think of. So my goal today is to try to overwhelm you. And it may make some of you uncomfortable or angry or disagree with me, and I welcome that. I'm just presenting this from my own study, and I'm not an expert, but these are some of the things that I see happening, and we can have some conversation around that. So I'll try to, in many ways as possible, and I have a lot of visual and audio aids here to help, to try to lift this up, and then we'll take a short break and then come back for discussion. Now, feel free to interrupt me if you want, but I am going to try to just run through these as fast as possible. The first of the costs that I want to share with you, if you could pass those around. Yes. One of the things I want to just show you is most of you come out of a time in history when the most the war that you think most about, I would imagine, would be World War II. It's the one that you were either involved in or had relatives involved in. It's the largest part of your memory. The reason I'm showing you this card is it just gives us a sense of where we've come since 1945. Okay, now if you look at the dot in the middle of that, does everyone have one?
No.
I'm sorry. Take a look at the dots in the middle of the sheet there. The single dot in the center, that represents everything that was used in World War II. That includes all of the powers, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that totals 3 million tons of TNT, or what we call 3 megatons. Now, each of those other dots represents also 3 megatons and has been developed since World War II. So imagine World War II, all of the deaths, all of the destruction, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, London, all of the bombings. Everything since 1945 is what you see on that map. It's 18,000 megatons, or 6,000 World War IIs. That's where we've come since World War II. So if you're thinking in a World War II mindset, drop that, because it's a different world. I want to give you a sense of this in one more way. Some of us are more visual, others have other ways of understanding. What I'd like you to do is to close your eyes, and I'm going to give you an audio demonstration of what you've just seen, using this that we have available to us, unseen in the world before. It's nothing like has ever been available to us before. Now, one of the rationales for having that kind of destructive power, or for as many countries having that kind of capability, nuclear capability mostly, is that it has prevented war. That balance of power has prevented war. When enough sides have weapons, they feel more secure, and it prevents war. Now, in fact, that has not been true. that it has prevented only one kind of war. It's prevented nuclear war, which I'm thankful for and we're all thankful for. But we do need to understand that there are more wars now and more people killed in them than ever before. There are 4 times as many war deaths have occurred in the 40 years since World War II as occurred the 40 years before World War II. In this century, about 100 million people have already been killed in war. More wars have been fought in the 1980s than in any previous decade in history. And in 1987, there were more wars being fought in 1987 than any other year on record. So when we talk about the arms race preventing war, it's only prevented nuclear exchange between the superpowers. It's not prevented other kinds of wars. Another thing I want to point out is that, of course, historically, wars have always killed both civilians and soldiers. But recently, the proportion of civilians in the death toll has been going up. In World War I, you see here about 95% of the casualties in World War I were soldiers. World War II, over 50% were civilians. That was the first time in a war that there were more civilian deaths than soldier deaths. So the characteristic of modern war is that civilian deaths are likely to be higher, because the traditional distinction between soldiers and civilians has been blurred. It's eroded mainly because the military of all countries now consider civilians to be legitimate targets, and that they can be legitimately targeted attacks to make war so unbearable for a country that they go to their leaders and request that the war end. In the 1970s, 73% of all war deaths were civilians. And in the 1980s so far, civilian deaths count for 85% of all war deaths. Another thing I want to point out about wars going on right now is that the geography has changed. It's one of the reasons that we don't notice all of the wars going on. We say that there's been relative peace for the past 40 years, only for a certain part of the world. During the past 3 centuries, Europe was the main site for wars and most deaths. But since World War II, only one conflict has taken place in Europe, and that's in Hungary. All other wars have been fought in the Third World. So because of the nuclear weapons and of their dangers, it's increasingly the strategy of the major military powers to play out their designs on the soils of other countries and with other peoples. Okay? Let me give you some examples. For instance, arms exports now. 60% of our foreign aid is direct military aid or indirect assistance to strengthening military allies. So less than a quarter of our foreign aid actually assists international organizations that are helping needy foreign countries. The value now of arms imports into the Third World has climbed above that of grain imports. So what we have now is many Third World countries that are poorer and they're hungrier, but they're better armed. Let me just give you a couple of statistical facts. Poor countries now spend 3 times as much on arms as would be needed to provide health care, clean water, and sanitation. The world's annual military budget is $1 trillion. That equals the gross income of the poorer half of humanity. Defense budgets in the Third World are about 7 times as large as in the 1960s, but for one person in two, the only water available is unsafe and possibly deadly. Every minute, 30 children die of starvation and hunger-related diseases. In that same minute, the world spends an average of $2 million in the military. Let me give you one specific example. And when I use the United States as an example, it's not because the United States is the only one who is militarized. It's because we live here. and that I think it's important to look at where we live and where we have the most control. But somebody asked about El Salvador and that needed to be pointed out, that the money going into El Salvador. Does anyone have any idea how much we pay to El Salvador every day?
$1.5 million
to El Salvador, which pays for more than half of the total expenses of that government, the military government there. 85% of it goes for military purposes. And what has happened there since 1980 is 70,000 people have died, 7,000 are disappeared, 1/5 of the population is now refugees, and 70% of the population lives in subhuman conditions and inadequate health care, without education. It's just an example of the cost to the third world. I'm forgetting to put these up here. There are more wars, and there's a cost to the third world. Okay, let me talk a little bit about the environmental cost of militarism.
Excuse me, before you do, could you're really overwhelming us. Could we define the terms in this first experiment with the garbage can? Is that the explosive...
the explosive capacity of all the weapons in the world.
Or does it include airplanes and maintaining the Pentagon and all of the...
No, that's just the megatonnage capability.
Noise.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This again is a place where we're intersecting with what Keith was saying yesterday and today. But even without war, the environmental the environment is affected by militarism. The technological developments, the larger standing armies, has led to a greater military demand on land and resources. The testing of weapons, for instance, takes a lot of land, and nuclear testing in particular, for instance, in the Pacific, renders the land uninhabitable for many species and for many, many years. Since 1945, thousands and thousands of weapons have been tested there, and now we're only beginning to understand the real effects of nuclear testing on the environment and on the local population. Extremely high radiation-linked illness has become apparent, and sometimes disposal of extra weapons and with toxic chemicals has severe effects on the environment. The military also uses an exorbitant amount of raw materials, including titanium, thallium, cobalt, and copper. And this week was the first time I'd ever heard that behind us, the copper mine behind us, the primary reason that Holden Village mine was so lucrative during the 30s and 40s was that copper was needed so much for the war effort. So in essence, we have, at least for part of the time, a war machine behind us that made copper for ammunition and bullets for the war. And I had never made that connection before.
We probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for those copper mines running in World War II.
Okay, again, that would be a whole nother conversation we could get into is you know, to what extent, that's what I'm not going to address today, is to what extent does militarism and the weapons actually protect us. I'm talking about the more of the social costs to the preparation for that. Anyway, that environmental impact that I was talking about, that's just if there's not any war. Then there's the environmental impact of just the destruction of warfare itself. Vietnam, Afghanistan, Lebanon, those are dramatic examples of what can happen to a land affected by modern warfare. The agriculture, the natural environment, the livestock, the wildlife. Vietnam really has not recovered from the Vietnam War. It's been so devastated. The damage tends to spread outward. War generates refugees. And I didn't mention earlier that there are 12 to 14 million refugees in the world right now because of war. And as people flee, they often tend to add an extra cost to the environment. And it's not their fault, obviously. It's just one of the costs of war. When large numbers of displaced people struggle to find a place to live in a limited area, it tends to harm the ecosystem. There's a way in which environmental damage itself causes and contributes to the conflicts around the world. In places like Central America and in parts of Africa, some of the causes of conflicts are environmentally related, stemming from the problem of overcrowding of land, the loss of jobs due to the erosion and deforestation. All of that creates breeding grounds for conflicts and for tensions. And then lastly, the impact of simply concentrating resources on military expansion means that environmental problems just don't get the attention that they should. For instance, in this country, the search for renewable sources of energy, and Keith has been talking about this, I assume, is being forgotten. 70% of the Department of Energy budget now goes for military expenditures, 70%. So problems like acid rain and topsoil erosion, destruction of the rainforest, the depletion of the ozone, they're going largely unchecked because of where our emphasis is going. They say now, he had up on the board, I saw a deforestation problem. They say now they have a plan to solve a lot of the deforestation problems. It would take 2 days of what the world spends on military. 2 days of military expenditures would solve the deforestation problem in the world. Now, you might be able to simply either ignore these costs, or we might be able to remain unaffected by them, at least for a while, by those kinds of costs, if we believe that militarism was protecting America and making us more secure, we might say that it was still worthwhile. Now, I think that tends to be a narrow view, because if the world is being harmed and there's all these costs all over the world, it also affects us. But let's go with that view.
That's been my narrow view.
How
are we going to control these other bandits out here?
That we have to worry about our own. Or we have to worry, is that what you're saying?
Do we want to sit here and discuss this in peace, or get rid of all of the defense mechanisms we've got and let somebody come over and take over?
Okay, well let's talk about the cost just to America then, and sort of narrow our view into what are the costs to the United States, and is there security in what we're doing?
I'm sure the costs are out of line.
Well, let's just look at it, and because I think it's very helpful for our discussion, just in terms of sheer dollars. In this country alone, since 1980, we've spent approximately $2 trillion on the military. Now, I don't have a sense of what $2 trillion is. I don't know if you do. But I did find something that described $1 trillion. So cut that in half and think of $1 trillion. If you had a stack of $1 trillion bills and you wanted to count them, and you counted them one per second for 24 hours a day, every day of the year, does anyone have any idea how long it would take to count $1 trillion $1 bills? Does anyone want to take a stab at it? Is somebody a guess?
150
years. 32,709 years it would take to count $1 trillion $1 bills. It's been figured that with $1 trillion, you could buy a $100,000 house for every family in Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Iowa. Then you could put a $10,000 car in the garage of each one of those houses. There would be enough left to build $10 million libraries and $10 million hospitals for 250 cities in those states. There would be enough left over to build $10 million schools for 500 communities. And there would still be enough left over to put in the bank, and from the interest alone, pay 10,000 nurses and teachers, plus a $5,000 bonus to every family in those five states. That's $1 trillion. It's about what the world spends per year, and it's what we've spent since 1980. Let me just, I'm sure that all of you pay taxes. give you a sense of where your tax where our tax dollar goes, this would be for fiscal year 1988, the taxes that you just paid in April. 35.8% of that would have paid for current military expenditures. 19% of it would have paid for past, we're still paying for the past wars, not only in veterans benefits, but in the percentage of the interest on the national debt that is attributed to past wars. That averages out, well, it's almost 55% of our tax dollar is going to the military. So when you pay your taxes next year, think about that. And the average per person, it figures out. I think there are a lot of different ways we could go in the next 20 minutes about this, and I've been debating in my mind what to do about that. What I want to do is may not be what you want to do, but I'm going to try it anyway. I'm going to try for us to discuss all of this in terms of our faith and to try to stay on that level. I think we could make the argument that perhaps at some times we have to leave our faith behind and ignore it and act in the way that the world wants us to act or the way the world acts. But I'm going to try for now to say, if we want to remain Christians and followers of Jesus, let's talk in terms of a faith level. In order to do that, I think that what we're talking about here and what all of I've been talking about is similar to what is most often talked about in the New Testament. Most often referred to in the New Testament is the word idolatry. It's the most referred to concept in the entire New Testament scriptures. And biblically, I think that we can talk about the arms race perhaps as a modern form of idolatry. Past idolatries, if you take a look at them, what are they? Past idolatries. It's something that originally served a useful purpose, but now has rebelled against God's intention. And instead of serving human needs as God intends, it turns out to be served exist to be served by humans, okay? And when a fallen structure goes out of control, it becomes an idol. And there's two characteristics of an idol. One, it demands an immense sacrifice which its worshipers willingly give over, and I think we talked about just now the sacrifices. And secondly, it promises a salvation that it can finally not deliver. I think we're also talking about militarism not finally being able to offer that kind of salvation. There have been other forms of idolatry in the past. Nazism was one of them. It demanded complete obedience from its followers, and it finally was not able to follow through on what it promised. I think of other idolatries that Jim Jones down in Guyana, who demanded a complete obedience. It was a kind of idolatry.
Seems that communism is one now.
It could be. I don't know. Again, we have to take a... I don't think we know a lot about communism. My last trip there, I couldn't find anyone who believed in it. Seriously. I didn't find anyone who...
Just the Kremlin.
Anti-communism is more an idol.
Maybe. I don't know. You know, there's lots of idols around. This one, I think, is pretty clear in my mind. It reminds me a little bit of slavery in the 18th and 19th century in this country, that slavery became an idol. I want to read a little quote from this book that I would recommend for reading if you're looking for a book that tries to tie together the faith witness and our response to some of these issues. It's called The Call to Conversion by Jim Wallace, and it's out on one of the front tables. I think Mary put it out there. Jim Wallace makes the case that slavery was not a political issue. It became a spiritual issue for the churches. And like slavery, the nuclear arms race, he says, is such a question today. Like slavery, our acceptance of weapons has brought us to a crisis of faith.
The nuclear threat and militarism is no more just a political issue than slavery was. It is a question that challenges everything we say about our faith in God and our allegiance to Jesus Christ. In other words, the growing prospect of militarism presents us with more than a test of our survival, it confronts us with a test of our conversion. And Wallace makes the case that because we're talking about idolatry, let's stop talking about the arms race as a political issue, even though it is a political issue, it's more than that. It's a spiritual issue for Christian people because it causes us to be hard of heart. Hardness of heart is what it makes us into, people with hardness of heart, and that we need to be converted. And Wallace says that if the churches decided that this was a spiritual issue, that would probably be the end of the arms race. If churches, people in churches, stopped cooperating rather than simply bemoaning the fact, we would not any longer have an arms race. I'm going to read one more section from him and then open it up for conversation. There have been endless appeals from the churches and from ecumenical bodies suggesting an end to the arms race. The problem with the appeals is that they have usually centered upon what Christians think other people should do rather than what Christians will do. This emphasis has been on what the government ought to do or what other citizens should do. Very few of the Christian statements have said, this is what we intend to do and this is what we refuse to do. The church has yet to say very clearly, regardless of what others may do, we will not cooperate with the arms buildup. We will not participate in nuclear war. We will withdraw our support, our energy, our resources, our money, our obedience, and ourselves. We will place ourselves and our faith as roadblocks to war and as signposts to peace. Jim Wallace once said, I was at a meeting with him, and he said that he reported he has a source within the Pentagon who told a very high-ranking military advisor who is sympathetic to some of the things he's saying, and that advisor, who he did not name for confidential reasons, that advisor told Jim Wallace that in a top-level meeting of military advisors, one of the chiefs of staff said, the greatest threat to all that we are about now comes from within the churches. The greatest threat to all we're about now comes from within the churches. I guess I just throw that out to you. First of all, I don't know that we all agree it's an idolatry. I think we could have a lot more conversation about that. But I do think that we are facing some sort of spiritual issue here, and that we need to confront it not only as a political issue, but as a spiritual issue, because to continue the way we're going really means a denial of so many things that the gospel talks about and what we talked about yesterday in our Shalom vision. And maybe the answer is we can't live a faithful life anymore. We just can't. Soviet Union's not, China's not, other countries aren't, then we can't. Is that the answer? I don't know. I'll just throw it out. We've got a good 15 minutes. I'm interested in your response. And if our discussion diverts back into very rational discussion, I'm going to stop it and say, let's go back to the faith level. And don't get mad at me for that. It's just, I don't think we do this very often. I don't think we stay on this, what does our faith have to say about a response? So it's not, if I stop you, it's not because of you. It's because of the way the discussion's going. We have 1, 2, and 3.
I just want to ask you the parameters. Are we talking about nuclear weapons or are we talking about all arms?
I would rather talk about a general trend in militarization or militarism, because
the whole thing would be reduced.
I'm not talking about in one day throwing away all weapons and having nothing. I mean, I don't think we're even in the position to think about that.
Maybe we're just going to be talking about the nuclear.
No, I think we're talking about generally all the costs that I've been talking about.
Okay.
Here?
It's a Christian stand, and so I've got the cross with it. I'm thinking of Archbishop Hunthausen in Seattle. He came to this, his decision about nuclear weapons particularly through a lot of prayer and meditation. He didn't, the first time he spoke his convictions was to a group of Lutherans. Mm-hmm. And he said he was withholding half his taxes because of that percentage that goes to war. And he has suffered a great deal because of taking that stand. Mm-hmm.
It was not because he was a Republican or a Democrat. It was because he saw the payment of taxes as a faith issue. And that somehow, I don't know where we declare it an idolatry, whether it's here or down here, but he saw this as a sign of idolatry. And he felt like the place where war most directly intersected his life was in the payment of taxes each April 15th. Similar to where some German Christians during the Nazi years tried to act in a nonviolent way and say somehow no to Hitler. It was too late, too few, too late. But at some point people said, I just have to say no. And I think John's going to talk tomorrow morning about Martin Niemöller, who had a dream that caused him to say no. But Hunthausen is one example of that. Yeah.
Well, I think this is absolutely right, and I think that it has become idolatrous. However, I also think that we are not a Christian nation anymore. Mm-hmm. We'd like to think that we are, but the Fresno, California, where we live, they said when we moved there 10 years ago, 28% of the people were churched. I guess my only point is, we as Christians are going to have to make a stand, but we can't let, you brought it out a few moments ago, we can't let them do it, or those other people, or the Congress, or, and we've become so apathetic in this country about everything, including going to the polls and voting, that we don't even vote out some of these rascals that are in Washington, D.C. that are creating these problems, and it almost becomes an insurmountable problem unless we as a group, as a church or whatever, stand up and be counted like Martin Luther did. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it happening.
That's very helpful. Of course, those of us in Minnesota don't consider California really part of the United States. So that's besides the point.
California is the land of the fruits and nuts.
Right. So that's very helpful. Does someone want to continue on that strain? That was a very helpful comment.
One young man he was part of the forum on a Sunday, and he said that he was going to cut off the amount of money that would go to the war from his taxes, and he just refused to send it in.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see what he put in.
One at a time, it's not going to happen.
Yes, but that can grow. That can grow rather fast.
Well, if you can convince groups and numbers of people, then we're on.
But let me push
the... A lot of people can't do that anyway. Yeah. Money's taken automatically out of the
country. Right.
That's right.
So
right.
It wouldn't really affect the...
Yeah, that's not enough.
You can't get it back after it's taken away.
Oh, no.
But wasn't there a movement in Congress a couple of years ago? I didn't get anywhere, that you would have some say on your... Where mm-hmm. the money would go.
The National Peace Tax Fund bill is a legal effort to do that very thing, so that you could become a conscientious objector to war through your taxes. In other words, just as young men refuse to serve, your tax dollar, you pay all your taxes, it's just that it would do alternative service. Now, that's a great idea. It doesn't give any less money to the military.
No.
It just means that other people are paying a higher percentage, but it does make a witness. It does take a stand, and if a sizable number of Christians decided that they could no longer in good conscience pay that, mm-hmm. I think that would be a tremendous witness. The one thing I want to call into question is, I don't have the answer to this myself. Is this, you know, a critical mass? We have to get enough people doing it in order for there to be something happening. And I don't know where to go with that, because it also starts with me. Now, there are many people employed by the military industry. There's about more than 6 million in this country directly or indirectly involved in the military industrial complex. And they're very good at producing what they do, but what they produce, we have to hope will never be used. Right? We have to hope that what they produce will never be used, otherwise we will all be in trouble. Now what this does is simply increase, it helps to increase inflation. Heavy military spending generates buying power without producing an equivalent supply of economic goods, useful goods for the market. Okay, whatever else you say about military goods, they don't have any economic usefulness. They can't be worn, they can't be eaten, they can't be lived in. They make no direct contribution to the material standard of living in this country. So, but people who produce those military goods, they're paid and they spend money on consumer goods or industrial goods. But the people don't produce a corresponding supply of those consumer industrial goods, which would absorb their money. So you have more money chasing after a constant supply of consumer goods. Now, taxes have not been raised enough to offset that spending power, and so inflation is one of the results of high military spending. You had a question here.
I just wanted to give a blatant example of
speak loudly enough
waste,
so everyone can hear.
Waste in military. I can just speak for my own outfit. I was in a night fire air squadron out in the Pacific during the war, out in Okinawa area, and at the end of the war, it was not cost effective to bring any of that aircraft back to the States. So I was, along with a few other fellows in our outfit, we just pushed our aircraft over a cliff, and they fight it off.
It's useless when there's no war.
Whenever an aircraft would land and would be somehow put out of action, everybody grabbed the screwdriver, and the first one that got to the compass and the clock, which was the only thing that was valuable in that airplane, that's all they got.
Interesting. Yeah.
The imbalance in foreign trade would be related to that also. If we have more money and aren't producing the goods we're buying in other countries.
Right, and I'm still coming to that, yeah.
I may be perceived as a hardliner up to now. I agree with about 95% of what you put up here. My only quarrel is, how are we going to get the rest of the world, which we haven't been able to control, to see it our way, to see it the way we would like to see it. Now, it's kind of naive to say, well, let's go over and talk to them, because we've been talking to Russia since World War II, and they don't seem to.
Right.
You know, every treaty that we've tried to have with them, they've broken it.
Okay. Now again, that's a very large. It's a debatable point that you're making, that Russia accuses us of breaking treaties.
Right.
Again, we can have a long discussion about that. What I'm saying is, our way right now is a militaristic way.
That's bad.
Our way, it is the world's way. It's a world problem. It's not just the United States. And I think what I'm trying to point out is that somehow we all have to turn this around again, and I don't think it's America going to say, do it our way, because our way is perhaps the worst. We spend the most in the world.
Eisenhower warned us against the industrial military complex, which we have now, and it's an anathema, really, is what it is.
Okay. Well, I have just about 5 more minutes, and let me finish this up, and then we'll have some of this kind of discussion, because I think those are really good points. The only other thing about inflation I want to say is that the raw materials that the military industrial complex uses, those are forced, the prices are forced up by military contractors, because most of them work on a cost plus basis. Does anyone know what that means, cost plus?
It's a rag, but it is.
Okay. And the rest of civilian society cannot operate on that. They have to minimize their costs wherever they can. So some of those people go out of business, which slows the economy, or they just pass the prices along to us consumers.
Right.
And that, again, worsens inflation. Another reason that people argue for military spending is because of the spin-offs that happen from the technology. And there have been some of those. I mean, I think Teflon was one of those. Velcro is one of those spin-offs. But they are relatively few considering the massive amounts of energy and resources we put into military research and development. And it's diminishing all the time because military technology is becoming so specialized and complex. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to adapt that technology to civilian use. I don't know if you know this now, but perhaps I think it's up to 1/3 of all scientists and engineers in this country are working on military-related projects. This is also an incredible drain on our civilian economy. Incredible drain. That military programs are taking a disproportionate share of trained personnel and research talent from the rest of our industries, and it shows. One of the other things that I want to point to, and this is one of the last things, that it's weakening our industrial base, that which has been the strongest part of our society forever and ever, as long as I can remember. When I grew up studying American history, it was always our industrial base that at least in the 20th century anyway. Let me just give you a couple examples. It requires a large number of scientists and engineers to produce military equipment. In the military industry, if you have 100 production workers, it takes about 7.5 scientists and engineers to research and develop what's being produced. Okay, in the civilian economy, it's one. It's one scientist or engineer per 100 production workers. So the simple fact is that we're using up a lot of our creative energy in the military industry, not in the civilian industry. And the drain on that talent by the military has played a part in weakening U.S. competitiveness. And it's brought a major decline in this country in our industry. If you're wondering why Japan is beating us economically, a major reason is that a lot of our talent has been diverted or slowed down, and our manufacturing productivity has been slowed down. Just give you a sense of the comparison. The annual growth rate of manufacturing productivity in the United States was 2.5 during this 30 years. It was 9% in Japan. The percentage of government research and development funds that were given to the military was 2% in Japan, 60% in the United States.
That's one of the biggest keys right there, is they don't have to defend themselves. We're defending them.
Right. Now, okay, we can talk about that. You know, we're defending Japan. I mean, part of our military spending doesn't go to defend us, it goes to defend other countries. Let me get at it another way. How many of you know where the shoes that you're wearing right now come from? Where were they made? Does anyone know?
Italy.
Anybody have some shoes made in the U.S.? Are you sure? Okay. Very, very difficult to find. In 1980, 45% of our shoes were imported. 1980. 1987, 86% of our shoes are imported. I cannot find tennis shoes made in the United States. If somebody knows where I can find them, please tell me. I'm trying to buy them. But I can't find them. They're all made in Korea or other places. Okay, what about automobiles? How many of you have an imported car? I do.
They're the best,
okay. 1980, 17% of the automobiles in this country were imported. 1987, about a third were imported. Soon it will be a half. Okay, how many have a Ford? But a Ford car. Half of the parts in your Ford car come from foreign countries. Chrysler, anybody have a Chrysler? 70% of the parts in your Chrysler car, if it's a recent car, came from foreign countries. I just read that up in the magazine room today.
They made or made in Japan.
Right, like the Colts, yeah, the Dodge Colts are imported from Japan. The machine tool industry is one of the most important in our country. It has been in the past. Imports represented 25% of the sales in 1980. Now it's 50% of the machine tools in this country are made elsewhere.
Japan and Germany.
Who has a VCR? Does anyone have a VCR? It's not made in the United States. There are none made in the United States.
We designed them over here, though.
Okay. Television. You have a television. Have you bought it recently? There's only one company now making televisions in this country, Zenith, and they're trying to sell it off.
They're going out of business.
Okay? Well, you learn from that, there's not only short-term job loss, but there's a comparable loss of productive employment. There are less people in this country making shoes, less people making automobiles, machine tools. The one thing that we are making a lot of is weapons.
We're making more automobiles in the U.S. now because Japan is building factories here in the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
They make good ones.
Money.
Importing their help.
But hasn't all that, and that has to do with export-import balance, doesn't it?
That's part of it.
Right, but we're now what people envision now is that we will in essence become what they call a fifth world country. I mean, you've heard of third world or second. We will become a fifth world country that we'll be unable to gather together the necessary resources to raise our people from poverty. And we have a good number of people in our country in poverty. We'll be an underdeveloped country lacking the resources needed for repairing our key industries. We'll be suffering a declining level of living. And as that spreads, as in any unindustrialized country, teams of workers or technicians or managers will have to be sent here from abroad to acquire the needed skills, or foreign staffs. We'll have to send our people to other countries to learn the skills, or people will have to come here to train the natives to repair what we now use, okay? So it's not just developing nations that are trapped, but in this country, 32 million people live below the poverty line. 8 million are unemployed. 1 million adults are illiterate. 10 million children without basic health care. And among the Western countries, we have an extremely high crime rate. So what I'm saying is that with all of our military strength, the United States, we're the most powerful nation in the world, yet we have been unable to buy national security with the weapons that we build. Now, we're going to break for 5 minutes so you can stretch and come back and talk about that. I just have a few minutes left to try to interpret that a little bit, and just have some open conversation about what all does that mean for us. Okay?
So one of your costs is exactly that. We're destroying our thought of who we are because of all the people who are not benefiting from our way of life. So we're having nothing to protect.
Okay.
That's a cost.
Yeah, there's lots of costs that I haven't listed. That's a helpful one. The another one is our children.
Well, the children won't care because they aren't seeing.
Children don't care today, and a lot of them are frightened. Part of the drug crisis has to be associated with people having this fear of no future out there for them.
I